Excuse me, everyone. The operator just need to inform you that this conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time, and you may begin.
Thank you very much, Lori. This is Julie Hedlund, and I'll go ahead and do a roll call for this meeting of the Internationalized Registration Data Working Group. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. On the call, we have our chair, co-chair, Edmund Chung. We also have Andrei Kolesnikov, Rafik Dumick, Bob Hutchinson, Jim Galvin. And from staff, we have Steve Shang, Dave Piscatello, Glenn DeSangery, and Julie Hedlund. Have I missed anyone? Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, and I'll turn it over to Edmund and then also to Steve Shang. Perhaps Steve could catch us up on where we were at the last call. I think we've been making some progress through this staff summary through page 3, but perhaps you'd like to lead us into that, Steve.
Is that okay with Edmund?
Oh, actually, I'm sorry. This is Julie. Let me just start with one other thing so we don't save it for the end of the meeting. We've had a request to have this call be switched to a later time. It is a relatively early time for people on the West Coast, but it's also a late time for folks in Asia. Edmund, if we were to start an hour later, would you be able to accommodate that?
For me, it's fine.
For you, it's okay?
Yeah.
Others on the call, would 1 hour later work for you?
I know. Yeah, it could work for me.
I'm sorry, who is that?
It's Andre.
Would that work for you?
Yeah.
Rafik, I know you're in Asia. Would 1 hour later still be okay for you?
It will be midnight.
Yes, quite late. So I hesitate to do that. Would you be able to do that, or should we stay at this time? I mean, we picked this time because it's sort of an in-between time for everyone. It's hard to find a time that works perfectly for everyone. So I'm hesitant to change it, but the request was made by Owen Smigelski, who's on the West Coast. And I see Steve Metalis has just joined us. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
Steve, I just want to let you know, this is Julie. We've had a request to perhaps change the call time to 1 hour later. That does make it challenging for folks in Asia. Edmund has said he can make it, but I know it's also a difficult time for Rafik as well. So I was polling the members to see if folks could start an hour later or if we should keep it at this time.
I could do either.
Rafik, what do you think? Midnight is awfully late for you. I hate to do that to you.
Okay.
You sure? We're not going to let you get much sleep. Okay.
I think all conf callers that they have are always late at night, so...
Okay. Well, very good, and thanks for being so accommodating, everyone. Glenn, if you could please note that we will start the call 1 hour later at our next scheduled call, which will be 2 weeks from now.
Thank you, Julie. I'll do that.
Thank you very much, Glenn. I'm sorry to take some time with that, but I thought rather than saving it for the end, we could check that off here at the beginning. Steve, let me go ahead and turn it over to you.
Okay, so I want to first give a summary of where we discussed last time. So the last time we spent about 30 minutes continuing our discussion on variants. Hello? And I think the discussion was that it's very difficult to have an accurate definition of variant, and because different organizations but different countries may define it differently. So I think that the working group members felt that it's not up to us to define what it is, but we can simply take what the definition that's given. Usually they are in two forms, the activated variant and also the reserved variant. And we and think about how to display those two types of variants in WHOIS. So I think we have agreement on the call last time, but a few members, that for activate variants, basically the variants that exist in the DNS, so a WHOIS query of the variant should return the WHOIS result of the original domain, as well as a note that this is a variant of the original domain. For reserved variant, that means the variants that are reserved but are not in the zone, there are two options. One option is a query of a reserved variant would only return a message saying that, this domain is a reserved variant of, XYZ domain. So that's one option. The other option is a query of a reserved variant will return the same information as a query for the activated variant. So that's where we are last time. So I guess, what does the working group think, I guess?
This is Jim. One question I have is, what does WHOIS do now with reserved names? I didn't think that it responded, but I guess I really don't know. Does anybody know for certain?
This is Edmund.
So you mean like example.com?
No, I mean for names which are reserved but not in the zone, and there are such names, what does WHOIS actually return anything?
Well, give me a name and I'll WHOIS it.
Well, yeah, I was thinking I could do the same thing too, but I frankly don't know a reserved name off the top of my head.
Why don't you try one of the single letter names in .com, A, B.com or D.com. That's reserved.
So actually, returns it ownership IANA. So it's created. So the com registry returns the domain d.com organization IANA created 1992-0101 source IANA. That's all you get.
This is Edmund. I think there are usually two ways to deal with reserved names at this point, just generally. One is that they're essentially registered into the registry with some placeholder data, so that it responds in the WHOIS, but it does not is not included in the zone by way that the name servers are not included. The other way is that the registry would actually have a sort of a list of reserved names whereby the WHOIS will also respond, but it's not a regular registration. The WHOIS would respond just saying that it's a reserved name. Those are usually from gTLDs and, in fact, a lot of ccTLDs as well. Those are the two main approaches, I think.
Well, this is Jim again. So based on that, I would think that for reserved names, you return a message that says that it's reserved.
Right. I think that's a reasonable requirement. But I think on top of that, I just want to make a couple of observations. I apologize I wasn't able to be on the call last time, but I'm actually glad that from Steve's summary, I think it seems like a good direction. And in fact, the sort of categorizing as activated variants and reserved variants seems to be a direction that makes a lot of sense for ICANN policy discussions, and not only in this context but also others. But for Whois, I think that makes a lot of sense in terms of how to deal with what type of data to be responded to.
Right. So I interpreted Steve's question to be asking if there was a preference, or is he just asking if those two choices represent consensus? I mean, that's why I just said I would prefer the first.
Well, generally, I think it's probably better to allow either, but I'm sort of open, but I feel that providing allowing either would provide a better choice for people to decide registries to decide how they want to present the data.
I'm okay with that.
So Anman, one of my concerns as I think about providing the second option, for example, treat the reserved variant the same as activated variants. When a computer user query a reserved variant and he or she sees the Whois record there, would that give him a kind of a wrong impression that the name, he can actually resolve that name? So,
interesting. I sort of read it. I guess I'm rereading it. When I read it, I thought the first option would only return a message saying, and the second one would return same information. I had interpreted it that it would still provide that message saying that it's a reserve, but it will also provide the information of the activated variant.
Yes.
So,
I
think you just asked the question, and I think it's more correct if that there is a message that says this is a reserve variant for XYZ domain. Because on your second point, you didn't say only the same information.
Okay.
But I think your observation is correct.
Okay. So you think that by providing a message saying that this is a reserved variant, the user will not be confused?
I think if we really want to add to it, then for all for all IDNs where there is a variant issue, there should probably be sort of a link to the policy, so that people can read the policy of how the variants are generated.
Okay, I'm fine with that. So what you're saying is providing two alternatives for the registrars or registries, but requiring them to at least implement option A, is that right?
That seems to make sense for me. And the other thing is, it might be useful actually to return a URL that that has information about where the policy is posted.
Okay.
I'm just making a suggestion here.
Okay. What do others think?
Well, I'm a little confused with now we've got two different kinds of variants that are two different kinds of reserved names that have kind of crept into the discussion. One is the style of G.com, where ICANN has, by policy, reserved those names. And the other one is the registrar's naming policy is reserving the name, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mix the two. Am I wrong to think that they're separate or they should be handled separately?
I think they are separate. In the context of our discussion, the reserved variant is the reserved variant of a particular domain name that is activated. In the ICANN or IANA's example, those names are reserved, you know, by default, like nobody else can register them at all. Am I correct? What you're referring to is, you know, if you're displaying the same message, then you'll get people confused. Is that your concern, Bob?
My point is that reserved variants, or whatever you want to call them, are not the same as IANA or ICANN reserved names. And I think that we shouldn't mix the two, is what I'm...
This is Edmund.
So,
I think that is clear. I think just to clarify, what we're trying to suggest, let us trace back to the conversation. We were sort of asking what the current, you know, IANA reserve names, how do they look like in Whois, as a background information for the discussion. Not really that it would be like the IANA one. So in terms of the IDN variants, what we're saying is that they are reserved for a particular domain, and the response would indicate which domain that this reserved variant is pertains, such that, you know, the user, when they're looking for this particular domain, they know why, you know, what state it is in. Does that?
That's fine. I just wanted to clarify that, you know, I think the two are different, and we should talk only, I guess, in this context about variants of domain names at the registry level, not
right.
the ICANN reserve names. Understand?
So
as an illustration. Okay.
So just to make sure I understand, this is Jim. You're making an important, I guess you're suggesting this is an important distinction. A name may be reserved, but it's reserved as a result of there are at least two different policies by which it might be reserved. You know, either by ICANN or by the registry, for whatever reason the registry wants to declare it reserved as. Are we going to try to split apart the reasons why a registry might reserve a name too? I mean, the thing that occurs to me is there are reasons why a registry might reserve a name outside of just it being a variant. Are we expecting a registry to create, you know, codes, if you will, or messages, if you will, to indicate all the possible reasons why something might be reserved?
That's another good question.
This is Edmund. I think that might be a little bit out of the scope of what we are discussing right now. What we're discussing right now is focused on the IDN variant. Whether there are, you know, other codes for whatever the registry does, at this point, I don't think there is any particular standard or policy for it. And I'm pretty sure that some different GTLDs implement that slightly differently at this point, because different registries do have additional reserved names. But I don't think there is a sort of a standard or specific policy for that. But on this particular discussion, we're talking about IDN variants, and I think it's useful to mention a generic approach, at least to let people know that when a domain is taken out of the available pool, this is the reason for which it's reserved, and the Whois information will show that. The other types of reserved names is somewhat not within this particular discussion, though I'm sure it's an interesting discussion.
certainly, I'm not suggesting that we would. I mean, I agree. The actual work is out of scope. I'm trying to understand, you know, the consequences or implications, if you will, of what we're doing here. So we're suggesting that we need to say that it's reserved because it's a variant of another name. It's not enough just to say that it's a reserved name. We want to say that it's reserved because it's a variant of this domain name. I'm simply observing that that's distinct from the way reserved names are handled today. And I think it's important to observe that we're doing something different than the way these things are done today.
Oh, great. Agreed. Yeah.
I will put that into the discussion, and we need probably spend a little bit more in the report as well.
It might be a suggestion for further work to look at, you know, reserved categories and standardizing those. But I agree with Edmund, we should otherwise consider it out of scope.
Okay, any other thoughts on variants? So it seems that we outlined two options that for the reserved variant, and we will suggest that registries or registrars have the option to implement the second type, so treating reserved names as activated variants, but at least they should implement option one. When someone querying a reserved variant, it should say this is a reserved names, a variant of, you know, the original domain. Okay, so we can wrap up that discussion. Thank you. Do we want to discuss other issues, or what do we want to do here now? We can talk about the document.
Yeah, Steve, this is Julie. Maybe I think in your notes you indicated that you'd gotten through page 3 of the document, the staff summary document. Perhaps you want to continue that discussion from that point?
Okay. Yeah, I think seems to have some preliminary recommendations for variants. So that's very good. That's a big thing. Let me see. So we were going through the IRDWD group, the staff summary last time, and the goal is, so the summary was essentially we turned a PowerPoint presentation from Brussels into Word, and we used this exercise as a way, to identify, you know, what issues we have discussed, what we have consensus on, and what issues that we need more further discussion. So we're going through that document, and last time we were on page 3 of the document. First of all, do you have the document handy? It would be probably helpful if we can have the document together.
This is the document from July 30th, correct?
Yeah, Jim, this is Julie. That's correct.
Yes.
Thank you.
But, Steve, this is Julie. You might also just want to read through a little bit just in case, some folks don't have it handy. I can send it around to people, but might want to describe what the next issue is that we're discussing.
Okay.
Is this document on the wikis page? I don't see it there.
I think it is. I think it is, but I think it's probably perhaps linked to an earlier note. Let me just send it quickly around to everyone.
Okay. But let me summarize what we discussed last time. When we discussed last time going through the first couple of pages, there was no problem. However, we stopped at this particular point. The point was that the existing WHOIS protocol has no mechanism for indicating a preferred character set to use, either for query input or for the display of the result of the query. So this is essentially a limitation of the port 43 WHOIS. And what we have in the document is a recommendation that the working group recommend interested parties to submit a proposal to resolve this to the IETF for consideration as a standard track RFC. So that's what I think the working group discussed. Basically, will call out this issue that the WHOIS lacks this capability, but we will not address it here. So discussions last week, we have a couple of discussions essentially saying, you know, if you go to IETF, you know, the IETF will simply refer us to IRIS, or, you know, so that's one option. The second is, you know, ICANN can do some work or pay someone to do the work and develop an informal RFC. Whether that will become standardized is open to question. And another suggestion is by Jeremy that in the interim report, we want to have a solutions section. So so we want to look at WHOIS, and we look at, like, other solutions, like IRIS and RESTful WHOIS that is currently gaining a lot of headwinds. Like, why they work, and, you know, why no one is adopting them, you know, sort of issues on that. Go ahead. Just want to open it up. I think this is an important question.
A couple of things come to mind. The current WHOIS, I think, sort of specifies ASCII. Am I correct? Is it a 7-bit clean ASCII?
Yes, it's ASCII 7-bit clean. Yes.
In that case, then there are really two. Just as a backwards compatible, you thinking there are two ways. You know, there's UTF-7, and there's also sort of like a MIME type encoding scheme that we could perhaps add in the report as one possibility of encoding the data. Has that been discussed last time? Because again, sorry, I haven't.
I'm sorry, I didn't get you. Could you repeat?
Well, just off the top of my head, there are two ways to look into this. One is perhaps utilizing UTF-7. The other is looking into a MIME type arrangement.
Yes, I think this is one point that Jim raised as a potential solution. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say the important thing here is whether or not backwards compatibility with WHOIS was a goal. You know, I mean, IRIS is not backwards compatible. And so, you know, I think the question that we have to ask ourselves is, are we somehow, do we want to try to force that something new be done that's backwards compatible, or shouldn't we simply adopt what is there. And, you know, a lot of people got together and proposed something which, you know, solves an awful lot of problems. I observe, I mean, on the issue of whether the IETF would even consider standardizing something else, it's hard to say. I suspect that the odds are not very good. The IETF has been getting more and more formal over the years in spite of itself and its best wishes not to. And protocols that compete with something that exists face quite a high bar and a big hurdle to even get published. I have no idea how that would be likely to turn out if we were to try to propose something or if ICANN were to pay for something to happen. I think the question that we have to ask ourselves is, why is IRIS or a RESTful Who Is inappropriate? And that's what we need to document. Or we need to provide a recommendation that this is the path we need to head towards. People need to begin looking at IRIS and getting serious about it.
This is Avery. Can I get in the queue?
Go ahead, Avery.
Hi. Sorry I missed the beginning of this meeting. I thought I was dialing in on time. But I seem to have jumped in the middle. I think that in what was just said, there's really two things. I think when we were talking about backward compatibility, we were talking about the data requirements and were the data requirements compatible. And indeed, we may find that there's a split in the data requirements, that there's a minimal set that would be backward compatible, and that there's a full set that might not be, and that might be one way to look at it, so that we're not trying to do some sort of flag day notion on, you know, who is the old and never will work, and something new, for example, IRIS, is the new and everyone must switch over. So I think when we're looking at backward compatibility, it's not, is IRIS backward compatible with who is, are the requirements for the data, which is what we've been charged with thinking about. Now the second question comes up. Okay, let's say that we do decide that a basic set is backwardly compatible, but we are recommending a fuller set be sort of an option that people should be headed towards across a five-year period, what have you. I mean, I'm just hand-waving very much at the moment. But then in that a more advanced set, we can look at what is a decent vehicle. Now, one question I have about what was just said was, aren't both WHOIS and IRIS IETF protocols, and so a recommended change to WHOIS would not be doing something that was some other protocol, but it would be taking something, and I do not remember at what level of standard either it or IRIS is at, but wouldn't it be doing something to something that is already an IETF protocol, so that coming in with something outside would only pertain if somebody were to go off and blue sky a completely new protocol, not if someone were to say, listen, how can we fix up who is? And again, hand-waving as to whether it is possible to fix up who is. Thanks.
I agree. I mean, I think Avery asked some really good questions, and I really, you know, don't want to speak for the IETF or its processes. I mean, she's been around it as long as I have, so, you know, it's hard to say what's likely to happen. You know, IRIS was at some level intended to be a replacement for WHOIS, but WHOIS was never made historic or deprecated. Could you make changes to it? Perhaps. I think if the changes got to be too extensive, somebody might step back and say, whoa, you know, we already did this once, let's not do it again. But, you know, I don't think we're going to resolve the question of what the IETF will or won't do here. Actually, I like what direction Avery was going in focusing on the data. And, you know, I think that we should do that. And I think that that's a way to make an observation that who is insufficient and IRIS is a better choice. And with Jeremy's suggestion of making a solution section, we could expand on that a bit. And maybe that would provide a basis for going forward with IRIS as opposed to trying to revisit who is, which I think, you know, we could make a recommendation that it might be possible to do that, but actually proposing anything that one might change would really be outside our scope here, I think.
This is Aubrey again. By the way, I wasn't recommending that we do the who is. I was just saying that that wasn't an outside protocol. Sorry.
This is Edmund. I just want to add, I pretty much agree with Jim in terms of, or I think a lot of people as a general inclination or sentiment towards moving beyond who is. But I guess what I was bringing up is really, you know, in a solutions mindset, I don't think we should completely, you know, in the context of having IDNs and existing who is services, I'm not sure we're at the point of abandoning it just yet. And in terms of suggesting a, let's say, a UTF-7 over who is, really does not change who is, as far as I understand. I haven't opened the who is RFC for ages, but I think it is purely just 7-bit ASCII data. It doesn't even have a format. So pushing IDN data in sort of what we have discussed so far via Whois in a UTF-7 encoding really does not change Whois and does not require a Whois change, which allows most of the things to be for end users to, or existing applications and all those kind of things to continue to work. But if you really want to see the Whois data, perhaps, you know, even in the solution session, we can point towards more modern tools. But I guess, you know, I still think there is value in the existing infrastructure that's already out there, and we really should not sort of make it really so discriminatory against IDN data. And hence, you know, there, if that is completely not available to existing Whois sort of infrastructure. That's my point.
Well, this is Dave.
I'm sorry, I was going to say that, but Dave, go ahead. You go first.
So I pulled up RFC 3912, and it's very interesting. That this is the Whois protocol specification 2004. And it's very interesting that the only time that it mentions ASCII is when it discusses the encoding of the carriage return and line feed. It does not expressly forbid the any other text encoding. And there's a section now called internationalization that we should probably all read and just appreciate, because it does say that in practice, some Whois servers, particularly those outside the USA, might be using some other character set either for requests, replies, or both. And what they point out is they take a completely agnostic approach in the RFC, and all they say is this inability to predict or express text encoding has adversely impacted interoperability. So if you read that, you know, to the sort of letter of the standard, there is nothing that precludes the use of any encoding. The only requirement in Whois, which has been historically the only requirement, is that whatever you send in whatever encoding, you must conclude the transmission with at the ASCII carriage return and ASCII line feed.
Right.
Yes.
But, so if you read that way, and you're looking at identifying possible solutions, it seems to me that one thing we could do as staff is enumerate the solutions and include the variations that that we would imagine people might want to choose to use, using the current port 43 Whois, using RWS and using Iris, and there are obviously all sorts of permutations. And we get back to, I think, what Aubrey's pointing out is the most important aspect of what this group is that we want to understand what the data are that ought to be that people ought to be able to submit and that people ought to expect when they get a response. And the standardization of how you transport it is a separate issue.
So thanks, Dave, for pointing out 3912. I had missed this update to WHOIS, and as you say, all it really does is remove the U.S. ASCII requirement. WHOIS still has the problem that you have no idea, there's no way to indicate what character set is in use.
Right.
So, you know, it just provides means, in essence, all this really does is say that one should regard or could regard WHOIS as 8-bit clean. But that's really all you get from it.
So Jim, this is Dave again. I see the possibility of WHOIS being very much in parallel with DNS security extensions. I could imagine an RFC, if you wanted to go this path, an RFC that talks about, you know, WHOIS extensions to support internationalized registration data. And it would seem to me to be very hard for the IETF to say that would be inappropriate because it already has said it wasn't inappropriate for DNS. It wasn't inappropriate for SMTP. So if we wanted to go the WHOIS route, you could do it that way. Yeah.
I guess... Not sure I want to get into a technical discussion right here and now. It's not immediately obvious to me how WHOIS could use DNS to get past the problem that it has here, or did I misunderstand what you were suggesting?
Yeah, you misunderstood me. Again, this is Dave. We had DNS, which could only support 7-bit ASCII, letter digit hyphen, and we wrote at least two sets of extensions to DNS, one for internationalized domain names and one for DNS security extensions. We had mail, SMTP, and we wrote extensions for that to support multipurpose internet mail extensions. Right? So why couldn't you do that for WHOIS in the IETF? Earlier, people said that it would be very hard to get the IETF to accept new standards because IRIS was in place. So I'm just responding to that saying I think that would be a very hard line to draw.
Oh, okay. So the response is, the hard is because it's a process question, and there's really just no way of knowing how that's likely to turn out, because it depends in part on, you know, who the area directors are at the time. You know, the way the process is supposed to work, you can even make an independent submission, but it still passes back. When it overlaps with an existing protocol, it passes back to the ISG to say something about it. And actually, I think what's supposed to happen is the ISG gets to put a statement in front about, I mean, you know, we're getting into sort of detailed IETF process things, but it would not be something which came out of the IETF, and it would be flagged as such, and it would have a preamble that stated that this conflicts with an IETF, you know, standard protocol, that kind of thing. So it's not that it's hard to do technically. It's a process question. That's really the only issue that we're raising here.
This is Aubrey again, if I can add to that. It's not necessarily that it would be in contravention. I mean, yes, the IESG does have to do it. Yes, the IESG puts a statement saying this was independent work. But that could still be something that was seen as part of WHOIS that was acceptable on, you know, the standards track and such. There is no preclusion that just because it comes from an external source, it will not be. And yes, if it's an end run around the processes or protocols, then the ISG probably wouldn't even let it through. And if it did, it would put that negative imprimatur on it. But oftentimes it would just put this was not produced as the product of a working group. However, you know, it has been through the reviews and it is approved, et cetera, type of thing. So I think you're right, Jim. There is no way to predict what will happen. But, of course, understanding how the IETF works and what gets through them as an RFC and what doesn't and what changes can be allowed is a process that someone would have to work. And again, I'm not saying I'm in favor of it or not. I'm really just saying that a solution shouldn't be precluded based upon the, you know, the process of IETF, because it is possible to make a change to a standing protocol and get it approved.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Avery.
Sorry, this is Edwin again. Steve, just I wanted to sort of ask, as we were talking about this particular point, I just sort of want to ask, and thank you for pointing out the 3912 and actually looking at the other who is just refreshing my mind, the RFCs. But so far it doesn't occur to me that anything that we need to, that we have discussed in terms of the data to be carried utilizing the WHOIS protocol, really I don't see any change required there. It seems to me that, you know, what we want for WHOIS to carry, you know, the type of data for WHOIS to carry is really a policy matter at ICANN, saying that if there's an IDN registration or if there's a registration with internationalized data, like contact data, but with an ASCII domain, there are, you know, these are the things that you should do, and that's actually in the, you know, for GTLDs at least, that's like in the agreement. The ICANN contract has a WHOIS section specifying what type of data and how it should be presented for each registration. So I'm not sure why we would have to, you know, even if we need to carry internationalized data, why would we would need to change the WHOIS for in a technical protocol level such that it can carry that kind of data?
Thank you. Dave, I have to stop you. I want to give a chance to our colleagues from Asia, Andre, Rafik, and Jian Kang. I think at your own organization, you deal with IDNs. How do you handle WHOIS, and what do you think of our discussion? Sorry to cut you short, Dave. I want to give people an opportunity to speak out.
Oh.
Andre?
Yes, I'm here. We handle this data very simply. We do not, yet, we do not allow the IBM characters in the WHOIS output. It's on a Latin script. And there's a couple of reasons why we do this. First of all, it's regular and daily work with different international organizations who is requiring the WHOIS output in order to find out, you know, the different violence of the copyright, the illegal content. Also, our power agencies in Russia working with, with election script without problems, and also other power enforcement agencies in Russia. They spent a few years trying to, educate and find out how to use it. However, with the new IDN, with .rf, we do allow the IDN characters in WHOIS output, but it's a matter of the registrar on how to deal with that. They set the rules, and basically they didn't change it yet to allow the IDN characters in the data field. So even for Russia, this problem doesn't exist yet, and we are pretty much comfortable with the ASCII in a data field when somebody registers the domains. That's basically how we deal with that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Adri. Jian Kang.
Hey. Hello. Jian Kang Yao. For the who is encoding for the current thing is use our national coding for example, GB231212. So, I mentioned UTF-8 or UTF-7 for the who is encoding. Actually, I support the UTF-8 encoding because UTF-7 is not really usually used for encoding. Also, the UTF-8/7, the RFC for defining the UTF-7, so the experimental RFC. So the current Unicode standard version 5 only lists the UTF-8, UTF-16, UTF-13, 32. So no UTF-7. So I think if which kind of encoding support, I think UTF-8 is okay, but UTF-7 is not commonly used. Thank you.
Thank you. Rafik?
Yes. I'm not working for an organization which is handling IBM. So I'm just wondering about what Edmund Faction said, that we may not need to change the who is protocol, but are we sure that the who is can handle other other characters than the ASCII? I didn't check the AFC for the who is. Just maybe we can check this point. And also, I am wondering about Iris, because I know that some CCTLD is deploying using Iris. That maybe we can check with in the CCTLD community about that.
Okay, thank you, Rafik. So what I'm hearing for the RU IDN is not an issue. Currently, it's requiring ASCII. The RU is comfortable with ASCII, but they allow IDN, and it's a matter of registrar policy. So Andrew, if a registrar in Russia does allow IDN, what encoding is it in?
Excuse me, can you repeat one more time?
So if a registrar in Russia does allow internationalized registration data, what encoding those data are in? Is it in the Russian encoding? Or is it
We use ASCII transcript, whatever language it is. It's all written in the app. It's not a translation of something. It's a transcript.
Transcript. Right. But do you allow, like, native internationalized registration data?
Regulation documents regarding our national IDN domain, yes, it is possible to enter the, you know, IDN characters in the data field.
Okay.
But the registrars, who is accredited by our coordination center, didn't implement it yet.
Oh, I see.
But also, there'll be certain limitations. For example, the contact data will be in ASCII for a long period of time for the reasons everybody knows why. I mean,
okay.
Easy.
Okay, thank you.
And also, we have 15 years of .ru behind us. And, you know, 3 million domains, and the market and the users pretty much in pretty free operate with, traditional license script. So there is no, we don't see it as a physical limitation. The IDN is more, goes up to the marketing thing, because it's hard to write in ASCII a certain Russian, sounds and letters. Why it's very important for us.
Yes.
But the WHOIS output will remain ASCII for a long time.
Okay, thank you. That sounds fine. Dave, were you having a point? Sorry to cut you short.
No, we can just go on.
Edmund, thoughts?
Yeah, I guess my sort of question remains with Jim and Avi and Dave there. I'm curious, what do you have in mind to change the protocol? Because it seems to me that it is a policy. It seems, based on what we're reading now, that it really is a policy decision as to what data elements and how we want it passed through, using the Whois. Of course, we can also point towards more modern tools and say, that's probably better. But it seems like if we focus on what the type of data points what type of data and in what format we want it in, the current Whois can actually handle it.
So,
well, the thing that the Whois doesn't handle is it doesn't let you say. I mean, if you give it a query of an IDN name, if you give it an IDN name as a query, the thing that it doesn't let you say is what language or variant you're using. Now, I suppose a particular registry could decide by policy what it's going to support, and if you send it a quote bad unquote query, then who knows what you might get in response. But as long as you send it a sensible query, then you'll get a sensible response. And I agree with that. But I think it's a real shortcoming that you cannot specify, what character sets in use. And I think that's an important limitation for us to remind people about.
Sure. I think that limitation is, it's really important to point it out. And I think it's and that's a clear limitation for the Whois protocol, and we can point people to the newer tools, as I mentioned, Iris or mainly Iris. But you point out there are two items that we probably need to discuss. One is let's use it a simpler example. If we query an ASCII domain and it comes back with internationalized data in the contact or whatever form. The other type of discussion that we need to have is how we query an IDN. So the query, the domain in question is an IDN. Whether we would be sending over, how we would be sending over to the server. So those are very different questions, perhaps.
This is Julie. I hate to interrupt. But I should note that we are 2 minutes past the hour, so we probably should wrap up the discussion. Steve, did you have anything else you wanted to continue with at this point, or should we postpone the rest of the discussion until the next call?
I don't have anything. It's up to Edmund.
I thought I heard Avery wanted.
Yeah, I was. I mean,
so maybe after Avery.
Okay, thanks. What I was trying to say is when you brought up the question, isn't it a policy question, I think we actually have two policy questions. One of them is what shape the data should have. And then there is another policy question about what do we believe should be done about tools. And I don't mean what should be done in the technical sense of we need to change, this parameter, we need to add these bits. But what I mean is the community needs to make a decision, this group needs to make a recommendation on should something be done with old protocols, should something be done to move to new protocol. That itself is a policy decision. Should this be done over a number of years? How should that have? And then the thing I brought up at the beginning is if we look at the first decision, what is our policy regarding the data, and we see some stuff that is mandatory and should be backward compatible and some stuff that isn't, recognizing that perhaps a small tweak to who is easier to make for a small basic set than to get everybody in the world to implement and instantiate and deploy Iris or some new protocol. You know, those are policy type decisions that get based on technical realities. But I believe we may actually have two policy decisions to make, one regarding the data and one regarding what we believe should be the required tooling, since some of that stuff is contractually indicated. Thanks, and thanks for giving. And again, apologies. I thought this started at 10:30, not 10, and so I blew it.
Actually, Aubrey, this is Julie. It did start at 10:30 last time, but we switched back to the regular.
Okay, and I just had the old entry continuing through.
And just for your note, one thing we discussed before you got on the call is that we're going to schedule the call for 1 hour later in 2 weeks.
Okay, I'll try to make sure I change my calendar as opposed to just leaving my repeat every 2 weeks entry.
Right, and we'll also send a reminder around as well. Thank you, everyone. Is there anything else we want to discuss at this point, or shall we adjourn the call until the next call for 2 weeks' time? Then thank you, everyone. Thank you, Edmund, and thank you, working group members. I hope you all have a good day or evening, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Julie.
Thank you.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie.